The golden age of radio is on the air. Morehead State Public Radio presents classic old-time radio programs from radio's golden age, the 1930s through the 1950s. On this program of the golden age of radio, Fanny Bryce stars as Baby Snooks. Hollywood is on the air with a movie preview of the 1937 film High, Wide, and Handsome, and a CBS special broadcast from 1940, London After Dark. Stay tuned for the golden age of radio after today's news from NPR on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, a movie preview of the 1937 film High, Wide, and Handsome, and a CBS special broadcast from 1940, London After Dark, during World War II. Right now, Fanny Bryce stars as Baby Snooks, as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Baby Snooks. Well, we pick up Snooks and Daddy, played by Hanley Stafford, where we left them last week. This rapidly bids fair to become the longest night in Daddy's life. It started at midnight when he returned from the country without his door key. After breaking in the house and wrangling with Snooks for several hours, they are both finally sleeping peacefully.
Daddy!
Huh?
Daddy, wake up.
What's the matter?
I'm not sleeping.
Well, go to sleep.
I don't want it.
Why not?
Because I want some ice cream.
Oh, ice cream again. Snooks, won't you give me a little piece?
A piece of ice cream?
No. I want rest.
Why?
I've told you a million times. The insurance doctor will be here soon, and I haven't closed my eyes all night.
Why?
Because you won't let me sleep. You've had me up 40 times on flimsy excuses. First the faucet was dripping, then the shade was flapping, and then
the blanket slipped, and then I had a cold.
Oh, keep quiet. Now you go right back to sleep this instant. Let me have a couple of hours rest. Otherwise, I'll be completely run down.
Run down and get me some ice cream.
No! Now go to sleep.
All right, Daddy. Good night.
Good night. What are you laughing at?
I don't know.
Oh. I'm going to join the army and get some peace.
Uh-huh.
Nothing. Go to sleep.
All right. Daddy!
What is it?
If I go to sleep, will you buy me a rabbit?
Yes.
What kind of a rabbit?
Any kind.
A white rabbit?
Yes.
I don't like white rabbits.
Well, I'll buy any kind of rabbit you like. Just let me sleep.
I want a rabbit that barks.
Rabbits don't bark.
My teacher says they do.
Well, your teacher's crazy. Rabbits don't bark.
She said that rabbits eat cabbage and leaves and bark.
Oh, that's a different kind of bark. She meant the bark of a tree.
Does trees bark too?
No, only dogs bark.
Why?
I don't know. Will you go to sleep?
Mom, tell me a story.
Snooks, do you realize it's almost 5 o'clock in the morning? And if I don't pass that insurance examination, I'll give you the licking of your life.
What's insurance, Daddy?
How many times must I tell you? It's something I pay for so you can live comfortably when I'm gone.
Where are you going?
I'm not going anywhere.
Why?
Because I'm not. I just want to be fit in the morning so I can get this double indemnity policy.
What's a double indemnity?
Well, I certainly stuck my neck out there. Double indemnity means if I die a natural death, I get $10,000. If I commit suicide, I get 20. Right now, that seems like a pleasant way of making $20,000.
Do it, Daddy.
I will not. Now go to sleep.
Mom, tell me your story.
No!
If you don't, I'll make a hole in my mattress and I'll eat all the stuffing.
Snooks, please. I'll turn that light off.
I don't wanna.
Well, I'll just unscrew the bulb. There. Now you won't be able to put the light on at all. Good night.
Good night, Daddy. Daddy.
Oh, what is it?
I heard a noise.
Oh, it's your imagination. Now go to sleep.
I think there's a burglar in the kitchen, Daddy.
Now, what would a burglar be doing in the kitchen?
Maybe he's going to eat the pie that Mommy made.
Well, it'll serve him right. Good night.
I heard the noise again, Daddy.
Oh, listen, Snooks. If you heard a noise, it can't be a burglar. Because if a burglar came in here, he wouldn't make any noise at all. Now, please go to sleep. Besides, I'm with you, so there's nothing to be afraid of.
I ain't afraid. I like it.
Well, don't mention it anymore. Now, good night. And if anything does happen, just keep cool.
You're cool, ain't you, Daddy?
You bet I am.
You're so cool, I can hear you shivering.
Well, never mind that. Go to sleep. Oh. Snooks, cut that out. Stop walking around. Snooks, get back in bed. You hear me? Get back in bed.
I am in bed, Daddy.
Then... Oh! Quick, turn on the light.
I can't. There ain't no bulb.
It's on the night table. Who's in this room? Come out, you. Oh, he got me. You horrible child. Your poor father's shot and you're laughing.
You ain't shot, Daddy. I threw the bulb on the floor.
Snooks, what am I going to do with you? You're making a nervous wreck out of me. I know I'll never get that insurance. I'll say your prayers and go right to sleep.
Bless Mommy and the baby and Uncle Louie and Mrs. Blitz and my teacher and the cat and the burglars and Aunt Sophie. Amen.
Have you finished?
Yeah. I suppose you noticed you wasn't in it.
Ah, good night.
Is on the air. Straight from Hollywood comes the musical event of the year. The first radio preview of new songs from the latest musical score of America's greatest team of composers. Just 10 years ago, in the fall of 1927, the late Florence Ziegfeld was preparing what will always be recognized as his greatest achievement. The most sensational musical production ever to start a whole nation singing. The Immortal Showboat. The first night audience and the thousands of audiences that followed thundered ovations to its authors, Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein II, for some of the great songs of this century, headed by Old Man River. Now, on the 10th anniversary of Showboat's opening, its authors repeat again with another spectacular musical production filled with a story of struggle, a great romance, and the loveliest music of the new decade. It is High, Wide, and Handsome. Reuben Mamoulian's new production, soon to be shown at the nation's leading theater. And now, by special arrangement with the Paramount Studios, we bring you a radio preview of some of the new Kern Hammerstein music. Just before the Civil War, there was another war in Pennsylvania. Mobs ruled in oil towns. Teamsters with their black snake whips were set against pipeline men. It was a struggle of spectacular proportions. But despite their enemies, despite the gangs and mobs and trusts that tried to stop them, a little band of earnest men put the pipelines through. In the dead of winter, they fought their way across the Alleghenies, burrowing through frozen soil, through rock and snow and ice. High, Wide, and Handsome shows this great struggle. It depicts spectacular scenes of the laying of the first pipeline. And Jerome Kern has written this dramatic musical interlude, as colorful as the desperate conflict that inspired it. Thank you. lovely Dorothy L'Amour, who brought you one of the year's most famous songs, Moonlight and Shadows, introduces another hit in High, Wide, and Handsome. It is the plaintive Jerome Kern melody, The Things I Want.
The things I get are what I never want. The things I want are what I never get. I'm just a discontented dreamer with a discontented heart. I'm just a gambler who can never win a bet. The things I get are what I never seem to want. The things I want are what I never seem to get. I'm just a discontented dreamer with a discontented heart. I'm just a gambler who can never win a bet. The kind of man I seem to find is one with fun upon his mind and not much time to spare. And then I find another kind who wants to put me on a pedestal because I'm fair. And then he leaves me there for someone else. The things I get are what I never seem to want. The things I want are what I never hope to see. And so it isn't any wonder now that I'm in love with you. But I'm afraid to ask if you're in love with me.
And now we are privileged to hear Jerome Kern himself play one of his compositions from High, Wide, and Handsome. It is called The Folks Who Live on the Hill, and it is sung in the picture by Irene Dunne. Jerome Kern playing The Folks Who Live on the Hill. Another composition, one of the melodious love songs for which Jerome Kern is so famous, is Can I Forget You, also sung by Miss Dunne in the picture. We hear it now as interpreted by the golden-voiced Irene Dale.
And all
One of the catchiest tunes in High, Wide, and Handsome is a folk song written for the marriage festival. It is called Will You Marry Me, Mariah? Written in the joyous style of the last century when elopements were rare, when all the neighbors came in for the wedding and sang the bride and groom off to a great start.
Will you marry me tomorrow, Mariah? Will you marry me tomorrow, Mariah? Your ma thinks I'm unsightly, your pa insults me nicely, but tell them both politely to jump in the lake.
I'll have no dilly-dallying, Mariah. I'll have no shilly-shallying, Mariah. So wait until tomorrow, Mariah.
But get dressed up in your bombazine and go to the church in the village green. Mariah, I can't wait to marry you.
Will you make my hands so ready? Will you take my socks to dark?
Don't forget that you're a handy man around the
farm. I'll have no dilly dallying, Mariah. I'll have no shilly-shallying, Mariah. Don't wait until tomorrow, Mariah.
But get dressed up in your bombazine and go to the church in the building green.
Mariah, I can't wait to marry you.
And so does this preview of new music by Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein II come to a close. High, Wide, and Handsome, the picture for which this great music was written, stars Irene Dunne with Randolph Scott, Dorothy L'Amour, Akin Tamiroff, Raymond Walburn, Ben Blue, Charles Bickford, Elizabeth Patterson, and William Frawley featured in support. It was directed by Ruben Mamoulian, who won the 1937 Critics Award, and was produced by Arthur Hornblow, Jr., the man who made such successes as Ruggles of Red Gap, Swing High, Swing Low, and Waikiki Wedding. It will soon be seen at the nation's leading theaters. This program was produced at the Paramount Studios in Hollywood. This is Gay Whitman speaking.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio and a movie preview of the 1937 film High, Wide, and Handsome, featuring host Gayne Whitman. We also heard Fanny Bryce as Baby Snooks, first broadcast on radio on May 11th, 1939. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s. When the Golden Age of Radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. In a moment, a CBS special broadcast during World War II entitled London After Dark. But first, here's Woody Herman with Blues in the Night from 1941 as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
We'll be right back. My mama done told me when I was a knee pants. My mama done told me, son, a woman of sweet talk and give it a big eye. But when that sweet talking's done, a woman's a two-face, a worrisome thing who'll leave you to sing the blues in the night. Now the rain's a-falling, hear the train a-calling, hooey.
My mama done told me,
hear that lonesome whistle blowing across the trestle, hooey.
My mama done told me,
a hooey da hooey, oh clickety clacks a echoing back the blues in the night. Natchez to Mobile, from Memphis to St. Joe, wherever the fall winds blow. I've been in some big towns and heard me some big talk, but there is one thing I know. A woman's a two-face, a worrisome thing who'd leave you to sing the blues in the night.
London After Dark. At this time, the Columbia Broadcasting System brings you a special broadcast, Life in a Blackout in the capital of Great Britain. During the next half hour, you will be in various parts of London, a city which had three air raid alarms today, the nerve center of empire. There will be pickups from various points in London, accounts of work, yes, and of play in this great city of a nation at war. And so we turn you over to Columbia's staff in the British capital, and we take you now to London.
And now we take you into the streets of blacked-out London. Down stately, crescent-shaped Regent Street, along Shaftesbury Avenue of theatre fame, into Charing Cross Road, London's Tin Pan Alley, and so to Trafalgar Square. Waiting there is Edward Murrow, known to you as Columbia's European director. Come in, Ed Murrow.
Is Trafalgar Square.
The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid sirens. I'm standing here just on the steps of St. Martin's in the Fields. A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance. One single beam sweeping the sky above me now. People are walking along quite quietly. We're just at the entrance of an air raid shelter here, and I must move this cable over just a bit so people can walk in. I can see just straight away in front of me Lord Nelson on top of that big column. There's another searchlight just square behind Nelson's statue. Here comes one of those big red buses around the corner. Double-deckers they are. Just a few lights on the top deck. In this blackness, it looks very much like a ship that's passing in the night, and you just see the portholes. There goes another bus. More searchlights come into action. You see them reach straight up into the sky, and occasionally they catch a cloud and seem to splash on the bottom of it. The little traffic lights here, just a small cross on the normal globe, are now red. The cars pull up and stop. I'll just ooze down in the darkness here along these steps and see if I can pick up the sound of people's feet
as they walk along.
One of the strangest sounds one can hear in London these days, or rather these dark nights, just the sound of footsteps walking along the street, like ghosts shod with steel shoes. A taxi draws up just in front and stops, just waiting for that red light to change to green while the sirens howl. There it goes, and the cars move off. More searchlights are in action. We've not yet seen any burst of anti-aircraft fire overhead. And, of course, this doesn't necessarily mean that there are planes actually over London at this moment. We've had these warnings before, of course. You can hear the sirens just dying away in the distance now. An air raid warden walks out of this shelter. The shelter here, you know, is the crypt underneath this famous old church just on the edge of Trafalgar Square. The crypt where, in days of peace, homeless men and women were able to find a night's lodging. Just here now, the steps of people coming up into this old church.
And so, farewell Trafalgar Square. And now, after that unexpected air raid warning, we're going to take you to one of London's most ultra hotels, where behind the blackout drapes, men and women are dancing in the main ballroom. We'll see what the effect is over there after the air raid warning. And so, just after the air raid warning is announced, the dancing goes on at the Savoy Hotel. The Savoy, of course, is one of London's most famous hotels. Upstairs are suites named after the Gilbert and Sullivan Savoy operas. Below stairs are the kitchens and cellars. And even in wartime London, few spots are busier on a Saturday night, air raid warning or not, than the Savoy kitchen. Bob Bowman of the CBC is stationed there now with the Savoy chef, Monsieur Lattery. Take over, will you, Bob?
Hearing is not excitement because of an air raid, but just the busy orders providing people with meals there. And of course, I'm sure you're all licking your lips because this kitchen, as probably a lot of you will know, is provided over by no less a person than Francois Lattery, who is certainly one of the most famous chefs in the world. As a matter of fact, his culinary ability has brought him honors from many parts of the world. He's a Chevalier of the French Legion of Honor, and he also is a holder of the Order of the Cordon Rouge, which was established by Queen Mary. Well, tonight he's presiding over this white tile kitchen with its red floors, its battery of chefs, and flying black-coated waiters who are serving those people who are staying on right now, staying on and still dancing upstairs. It's wartime, and we have rationing. Nevertheless, I don't think you'd notice any difference at all. The menu tonight includes 8 hors d'oeuvres, including caviar, 8 different kinds of meat and game, and nevertheless, I don't want you to think that we're living luxuriously, sort of out of keeping with the war effort. Printed in red letters on the menu is this sentence: by agreement with the Ministry of Food, only one dish of meat or fish or poultry may be served at a meal. Still, that's not a great hardship, is it, not to be able to have both fish and meat? And even at that, the genius of Mr. Lattery comes into effect because he's designed marvelous crustaces and plate de travail, as he calls them, which have a fish base and which can be served before the main course. Things like Crab Maryland and all that sort of thing. Well, here he is, Francois Lattery, in his tall white cap. Francois Lattery, one of the world's most famous chefs.
I'm very happy to say hello to my friends across the Atlantic and to tell them we are well and food is plentiful. The war has not affected my cooking.
These are dangerous days, wartime days, and not for an instant can the watch on London be relaxed, as, for example, the air raid warning we had a few minutes ago. And so, unobtrusively guarding the city as crowds go home, or as people sleep, or night workers start their shift in armament factories, anti-aircraft guns are posted.
searchlight batteries ready in an instant to pierce the sky. Somewhere in London at this very moment, Raymond Glendenning of the BBC is stationed at an anti-aircraft gun post, and we'll hear from him now.
Standing as I am beside the command post of an anti-aircraft battery somewhere in London, I'm able to give you a picture of Britain at war, Britain in action. Beside me at the moment are many khaki-clad figures, all with steel helmets and with their gas masks at the alert. Just over 10 minutes ago, the siren sounded, warning the civilian population that an air raid was in progress. Before that, the alarm had been given here, and men had rushed from the huts where they were sleeping to their posts, manning the four guns, each in its own emplacement, and this central control point. The working of an anti-aircraft unit is entirely done from the command post. The instruments are on either side of us. As I stand here, just beside me is the spotter, or the identification telescope, which is first able to locate the plane in the beams of the searchlights. At the moment, our actual enemy planes are no longer in our vicinity. We heard the drone of them overhead, but they seem to have gone away from us now to the northward. And at the moment, the spotter is only using a pair of binoculars. As soon as the searchlights, which about a few seconds ago were zigzagging across the sky, stabbing in all directions, a myriad shafts of light looking for those enemy planes, they've all gone out one by one as the plane has passed on its way. And we're left here with the men just on their incessant vigil. This is just one of the pieces of practical turnout that they do at any time during the 24 hours and have been waiting to do at any time since this war started. Now, beside me is this spotter identification telescope, which as soon as the searchlights will get onto an enemy plane, will locate it. From that will be called the bearings and the angles of sight, which will enable a remarkable machine called the predictor in the left pit to get onto the plane, follow the target, and locate the guns. Now, here is the command from the GPO, who is the gun position officer. The predictor works its way around. The men are all standing attention. And now in this dim light, I can see the four long tapering gun barrels staking round till they come to the required bearing, which is in the direction of the expected enemy. Beside me, the height-finding apparatus, which this time is on my right, in the pit on my right, is now calling out the height at which the enemy is expected to come. I can now hear the distant drone of planes, searchlights, stabbing and crisscrossing, across the clear sky and into the cloud and out again. It's some distance away at the moment. All there is here is absolute tenseness and vigilance.
That was an anti-aircraft gun post, and no less vital than searchlight units and anti-aircraft batteries is another now familiar aspect of the London wartime scene. Air raid precautions, known simply as ARP. And so next we're going to take you to an ARP post just a few minutes after an air raid warning has sounded, where Larry LeSueur of CBS is waiting to set the scene as he sees it.
Good evening, this is Larry LeSueur. The London air raid sirens have just sounded. I'm standing in the vast basement of one of the largest apartment houses in the world. Around me are about 100 people, but they're only a small fraction of London's great air raid precaution force, which is ready to push to the scene if bombs are dropped in this area. This is the organization, the one which the British gift for reducing everything to initials has shortened until it's simply called ARP. These ARP men and women are the ones who are standing by to help their fellow Londoners when the air raid sirens just sent the other 8.25 million into the air raid shelters. As I've said before, the sirens have just sounded, and here's how the mechanics of this great air raid precaution system worked. Perhaps some half dozen German bomber pilots penetrated the coastal defenses of Britain a few minutes ago, and they're heading for London. There may be only a half dozen of them, but the killing powers of each man has been multiplied to incredible limits by science and high explosive bombs. An observer in a lonely observation post spotted these German raiders coming over. He telephoned the information to the Air Force Fighter Command, and the Fighter Command determined what point the raiders were heading for. It was London. Then they phoned the London Control Center a few minutes ago, and that telephone message was passed on to the place where I'm standing now, about 10 minutes ago. The message said simply, air raid message yellow. The word yellow stands for the same thing it does in traffic signals. Be on your guard. Everyone here grabbed up their equipment and stood up expectantly, with a keen look on their faces, men and women both. Then the telephone rang again. The words came through, air raids message red. And a few minutes later, the agonizing wail of the London sirens began, rising and falling in their quavering note. The people in this ARP station all got their equipment ready now, and they've started the motors of their first aid cars and their ambulances. The doctor on duty is busy sterilizing his instruments and preparing his bandages. The German bombers may be nearby now. There's a drone of engines in the air. I can't tell, though, whether they're British or German planes. If a bomb drops in this ARP district, a telephone call or a messenger will instantly bring the news of its location. And each of these blue-uniformed ARP men and women carrying their full equipment, which consists of steel helmet, gas mask, gas clothing, boots, first aid equipment, and flashlight, will be driven to the scene in ambulances at fire engine speed. Now, for your benefit, Mr. William Sutton, superintendent of this ARP Bureau, has arranged for a practice air raid bombing call to arrive at the station, although no bombs have been dropped nearby, so far as I know. We'll see how long it takes his men and women to get going. There goes the telephone now.
Air raid message, red.
Stretcher party, 10-1, stretcher party.
One ambulance,
one car to 114 High Street.
Sector 220.
Messenger!
Well, you've just heard the way that two vital spots in London's defense system reacted to an air raid warning. But now, let's get back to the bright lights, away to the west, to the Hammersmith Palais, London's giant dance hall. We'll see what's happening out there now that the sirens have sounded, and we'll see it and hear it from Columbia's Eric Severoid, who's standing with his portable microphone in the thick of the crowd.
Big dance floor. I guess it's the biggest in England, and it's got the biggest crowd I ever saw trying to dance
in one place at one time.
There are 1,500 people in the place at the moment. It's 15 minutes before midnight, and that's the wartime closing hour for Saturday night.
There was an air raid alarm, as you know,
15 minutes ago.
The orchestra leader simply announced they'd go on playing if the crowd wished to stay, and I don't think
more than a half a dozen people have left. They simply put up a big cheer and went on with their song.
Eddie Cole's orchestra is playing a song called A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square.
This crowd loves this song, and judging from the last one,
that partial to Old Johnny. We're a long ways from Berkeley Square. We're a sixpenny bus ride from the heart of London. They come here by bus and subway.
This is not Mayfair.
Nobody comes here to be seen
or to see.
They come to dance for the pure pleasure of dancing. And any American who thinks the British are a phlegmatic race should see them dancing around me here tonight. They love dancing, and they shop girls, these workers, these grocers, clerks, these people who make up the stuff of England, they dance wonderfully well. They're not all English by a long ways. The New Zealanders, Australians, and Canadian soldiers and sailors are here, and I just met a couple of Texans now in the RAF. There's a few French and Polish soldiers, and there right in front of me is a grave-looking Dutch officer in his well-tailored green, just gliding past. When they come in, these men take off their army boots and they're given little black dancing fops. This was a dance place at the end of the last war.
Well, it seems that it takes more than an air raid siren to dampen the gaiety at the Hammersmith Palais. But now, another long hop back to London's West End, from west to east, to the hub of the universe, center of cosmopolitan life in happier days, which we hope will soon return. We're taking you to London's heart of hearts, where on a balcony, stories about Piccadilly Circus. Vincent Sheehan of CBS is standing to describe Piccadilly after an air raid warning.
I'm standing on the balcony on Piccadilly. Perhaps I'd better tell you exactly where. It's the Piccadilly Hotel, about 150 yards from Piccadilly Circus, a little bit beyond St. James's Church. As you know, I suppose, I don't know if you heard the siren, but there is an air raid on. an air raid alarm, that is, 10 or 15 minutes ago. There was plenty of traffic in this street, even in spite of the blackout. Now, a good deal of it has drawn up to the curb or disappeared one way or another. People, I suppose, a good many of them, have gone into shelters. And it's a little bit quieter than it usually is. Even in spite of the blackout and these alarms, which people in the center of London don't usually hear much of, Piccadilly is still the center of the shopping and the theater and cafe and restaurant life of London. I had dinner not long ago in a restaurant just off Piccadilly Circus, where there were Hungarians and Austrians playing their music, much as usual. The food didn't seem much different, nor did the crowd, except there were a lot of officers and people on leave from the Army and the Navy Saturday night. They played Viennese waltzes and other music of those countries which no longer are able to play their music. The traffic seems to be not very much disturbed by the air raid. We've got taxis, and you probably can hear, I don't know whether you can hear or not, the buses still going on, some of them. The moon has just come up over the black buildings over there on the other side of Piccadilly Circus, the Criterion Restaurant. And the searchlights, which a few minutes ago were stabbing the whole sky with great long beams, seem to have disappeared altogether.
Well, that was Piccadilly in the blackout during an air raid warning. And now from Piccadilly, we take you to a London terminus, smoky, sprawling Euston Station. It only costs a penny to buy a platform ticket, which allows us to mingle with the travelers who are about to leave for night rides north. And at Euston, we're going to hear from Michael Standing and Winfred Vaughan Thomas, both of BBC.
Well, you're on number 13 platform at Euston Station, and let me tell you right away that this air raid warning has had very little effect here except to slow things down and crowd things down a bit. The platform's dim, there are only those very faint blue discs lighting up the numbers of the platform, a few little dim red lights, and otherwise complete and abysmal darkness. Well, we are here on this platform to watch the 11:55 up to Manchester start off on our journey. She's got a couple of minutes yet before she starts off, and she's drawn by the Royal Scot, number 6100. You've seen that powerful crimson beauty out there in the United States and Canada some 7 years ago, and now here she is, back here in her own home country, and going to draw her 11 coaches and her complement of passengers up on our routine journey up to the north. Well, Euston's a fairly busy place in this wartime, as the station master, Mr. Harrison, will tell you for himself. That's right, isn't it?
Very busy, just a pleasant time. Practically 50% of our mainline trains today have been duplicated. Incidentally, within the last 2 hours, we've dealt with approximately 200 tons of newspaper traffic, which is going all over the British Isles.
Well, we watch the newspapers being loaded up tomorrow morning, newspapers being taken up to the north. But now this train is a moment or two before she's due to leave, and so let's spend that moment or two pushing through the doors of the YMCA canteen and see what's happening in the canteen.
Well, here in the canteen, we've had a constant stream of men in uniform coming in all through the night. Sailors were joining their ships, and soldiers piled high with rifles and equipment, and they all seem to want that quick cup of tea. Well, they've been getting it, too, with truckwork efficiency, because the canteen's been run by an American lady, Mrs. Lubus. Well, she's got a job on, all right. Everybody in the services turns up here sooner or later, and they get not only tea, but quick meals, just like burly seaman Bob Smith, who has been tucking in here all night. What have you been eating, Bob?
Well, some egg and chips, and aliens, you heard it, in Southern Alder. They get plenty of food in this country, so you've not been much to worry about as long as you get a good feed.
Well, it's largely due to a seaman like Bob Smith that we're getting that food, but his pal, who is Sapper Hilling, he's also been tucking in.
Yes, we've had a jolly fine evening there. We've had eggs and chips and plenty of tea. That's the main thing, as long as we get something to drink and some good food.
And they've got that. It takes more than bombs to stop these boys getting into this canteen. And it takes more than bombs to stop that 11:55 going out. And we take you back to the platform now to see if she's getting out on time.
Well, seems the only effect of that air raid warning at Euston Station was to make a train a couple of minutes late. And now to our final port of call.
Standing in the shadow of the cenotaph, monument to the fallen of the last great war, is someone who needs no introduction to you wherever you may be. To close our tour of London after dark and London in an air raid warning, J.B. Priestley.
I'm sitting at an open window in Whitehall.
The roar of traffic has dwindled to the few noises that you probably hear because, of course, of the air raid warning. But we still get a few buses passing, a few cars. Just opposite me is the tall, pale, rather ghostly shape of the cenotaph, commemorating a million dead, many of them friends of mine, boys that I played with as a boy, men that might have been leaders now. Behind are the great government offices, the Home Office, the Colonial Office, the Treasury. It's the heart of our great capital city. It's also historic ground. Henry VIII married Anne Boleyn near here. Elizabeth saw Shakespeare's plays and the masks of Ben Jonson near here. Charles I was executed a few yards from where I'm sitting. It's historic ground, and I think today it's probably more deeply sunk in our world's history than ever, because it's the very center of the hopes of free men everywhere. It's the heart of this bastion, this great rock, that's defying the dark tide of invasion that's destroyed freedom all over Western Europe. Soon, I hope, the all clear will come. Soon, I hope, London, which has worked hard all this week, can go quietly to bed, can go to sleep. I hope it will dream of a better world, a world when they can take the balloons out of the sky and the planes, dream that dream and not sleep too long, but make that dream of a better world come true. Good night.
And that's London After Dark. London in the blackout. London in the midst of an air raid alarm. The world's largest city at midnight with air raiders in the vicinity. As this broadcast opened a half hour ago, the sound of sirens was heard. London's fourth air raid alarm of the day. Sirens wailing and descriptions of searchlight beams fingering the sky. And you were taken from point to point in this London under alarm. The defenses of London were manned, but the nightlife continued and the dance bands played on. The CBS staff in Britain and the British Broadcasting Corporation brought you the eyewitness story of this city at war. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Well,
die. I'm a fool, just say so. Should I keep dreaming on? Or just forget you? What shall I do?
The Golden Age of Radio on WMKY. Little Jimmy Scott and Lionel Hampton with I Wish I Knew from 1950. We also heard a CBS special broadcast during World War II entitled London After Dark, first broadcast on radio on August 24, 1940. This has been the Golden Age of Radio, classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows on the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the Golden Age of Radio next week at this same time and channel on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.